Support for the Source podcast comes from UT Health San Antonio, South Texas' largest academic research institution, where what is discovered in its labs translates into life-changing patient care. More at groundbreakingresearch.org.
Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. President Lyndon Johnson signed the Public Broadcasting Act into law on November 7th, 1967, declaring that, and this is his quote at that time, it will give a wider and I think stronger voice to educational radio and television by providing new funds for broadcasting facilities. It will launch a major study of television's use in the nation's classrooms and its potential use throughout the world. Finally, and most important, it builds a new institution, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. That was the promise of public broadcasting at the time, a bulwark against what was called then the vast wasteland of commercial broadcasting. So what did we get out of that creation of public broadcasting? Did we follow up that promise, or did we exceed that promise? So we're now joined by Josh Shepard, and he is the author of a book about the history of public broadcasting and what we arrived at today. And Josh Shepard, welcome to The Source.
Thank you for having me.
So when Johnson signed that document, there was a real fight in Congress in order to get this passed to a Corporation for Public Broadcasting form. And what did they think they were creating?
Yeah, so before the Public Broadcasting Act of 1967, there had been close to about 35 years of advocacy from numerous sectors, education, the philanthropic sector, and even the commercial sector, so that there could be, you know, some kind of provision for access from public education, from like localism, like just different local communities to talk to each other in different ways. And when they hit 1967, there had already been a series of bills that had preceded it that essentially had come from the educational sector, such as just building facilities so that there could be equal access to education from rural communities, from different immigrant communities. And 67 was a ratification of that previous 30-something years. But then again, what it also did was that it challenged both the commercial sector and then sort of a libertarian sector that had hoped to prevent the provisions of more public services.
The idea that the airwaves, the frequencies that we use for terrestrial radio, and at the time that's all we had, terrestrial radio, that was a public good, but it was a limited resource, that we needed government involvement in order to protect it and make sure that it was used for the public good. But that's been something that's been kicked around for a long time. What exactly did that mean, broadcasting in the public good?
So the U.S. has a very idiosyncratic model for public media. Its earliest policies go back to the 20s and 30s, in which they define our public, just a national public, in terms of what they called public interest. And public interest was really just the contours of ownership between different corporate stations that could provide a full day of programming. And the definition was pretty interesting in the 1930s. The public interest was what the public was interested in, which sounds preposterous and contradictory in some ways. And so a public good in the U.S. has typically been associated with privatization. And what happened was, in the process, concepts of public service or a public good in which different members of local communities could then talk to each other took the back seat to more technical models or technocratic models that affiliated with the businesses. But what they found really by even the end of the 1930s, after early regulation, was that a public good to mitigate the effects of rhetoric from fascism, or a public good during the Cold War, or what does it just mean for farmers who can't make it to the university because they're working the fields all day or tending to livestock? What does it mean for them to have the exact same education, from 20, 30 miles away from a city like San Antonio?
Right, but that was the original view, that they thought, well, we could use radio to teach classes. They even had, how to paint classes over the radio at the time, which is kind of hard to imagine. But, you know, they really created a lot of different types of programming that were supposed to be educational and informative. And that is clear to say that was a public good. But even today, I mean, this is still the law today, and people are supposed to be, you know, using the airwaves to provide a public good. And I'm not sure how you can say, you know, some of the commercial radio that I hear, and they're preaching anti-democracy talking points. How is that a public good in the view of the FCC?
Right. So the public interest model was largely technical. It was just, can a station be on all day long and have a listenership? But the public good motivation builds in momentum. And it's exactly what you just said. It's the way that different communities could have the same education that began to incite what becomes public media. So, yeah, I mean, the distance learning models that you see out of local land-grant universities, school districts, those become the concept of equal access to information and education that drive the policies through the 40s, 50s, and 60s until the Public Broadcasting Act.
And so the creation of the Public Broadcasting Act, radio was actually an afterthought in that act. They were mainly thinking about television, weren't they?
So the original Public Broadcasting Act was the Public Television Act, and they had not included radio at all. And I've actually seen the original document, which was in Austin, in which they cross out the word television on the document, and they write in radio, public broadcasting instead of just television all throughout, which is a lot of pages, dozens and dozens of pages. But yeah, I mean, the wider facilities that were available to transmit to all the most even remote communities, the types of programming by which people could learn trades, but then also learn about history and learn about culture. These became the trademarks of public good, as you mentioned before.
So how are we testing that today? How are we making sure? I mean, you know, obviously we have Pledge Drive and people support us with their dollars. That's one way to tell if you're providing a needed service. But how else can we tell?
So I would say, actually, your show is a really good example of public media working at its finest. And as I've been sort of circling today so far, local journalism that does not have incentive from a profit motive tends to be more realistic about the actual needs of the community. And public media works from barely any money. It's like $3 per person per year or something like that. And it manages to actually do so much of the local coverage that commercial media has begun to deaccession because there's a lack of profit from simply covering local news. And it costs a lot of money to do investigative journalism, to, you know, manage the facilities themselves, just like a transmitter or the microphones. So public media is more crucial, I think, than it has ever been because of the local journalism dimensions and because local journalism will cover the stories through public media that no one else will.
There is still this debate about how local a local station should be. We're seeing so many chains of radio stations where there is no actual person working in that at that radio station, at a commercial radio station. They could be a completely automated voice that was programmed hundreds of miles away. I mean, how there is supposed to be a local component to a local station, isn't there?
So in 1996, Bill Clinton passed something called the Telecommunications Act, which allowed for what they called, in regulatory language, consolidation, which meant that one company could own a much larger share of a market than before that. It was pretty devastating for a lot of locally owned stations who were by default doing localism because it was just local people having local music or having local talk and those types of things. So yeah, we were seeing sort of an unprecedented degree of ownership, especially on the FM channels, that are simply just pop music, and I like a lot of that music, but you'll have a lot of repetition on the bandwidth now that was not even allowed before the 1990s. And this is, of course, another reason that public radio in particular has taken additional emphasis.
So we know that if you want to find your public radio station, you go to the left part of the dial, and that's not a political spectrum kind of a question. It's not the Overton window to the left. But why is it there? You know, why that part of the spectrum?
So The answer for these questions, there were two sides of the dial that were experimental in really early radio regulation, and so it would be the right and the left side. And a lot of radio begins with AM. So, you know, AM's not even on some dials anymore, but they had a certain bandwidth and frequent set of frequencies that were available, and they called it frequency scarcity at the time. There were only so many available because of the technology of the time, but they kept expanding. And so, you know, eventually you can go up pretty high, up to the 1500 bandwidth on AM. And that was also true for public media with the regulations passed in the 50s and 60s, was that they simply didn't have receivers with numbers that low at the beginning. And then those were the open channels that could receive what they called protected or non-competitive frequencies, so that commercial stations were not given preference simply because they owned a better technological infrastructure. There could be more experiments, and there could be more like college access, public access, educational access.
All right, and so that's why we have on that part of the dial, you can either have like a religious broadcaster or your local public radio station there. But you know, a public radio station could be anywhere on the dial if they could afford to buy that valuable part of the spectrum. We're going to take a break now, and our phone lines are open. If you got a question or a comment about the public broadcasting system that we have today, one that you remember as in the past, how do we get here? And what were the promises, and were those promises kept? And where are we going in the future as a non-terrestrial broadcasting, internet broadcasting, satellite broadcasting, cable? You know, what does that mean for the future of serving the public? The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. The source continues right after this quick break. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. With me on the line, Josh Shepherd. He is a historian of the media. He is the author of the book, Shadow of the New Deal, The Victory of Public Broadcasting. If you get a question or comment about public broadcasting, how we got to where we are today, and what does the future look like, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. So, Josh, the picture I'm getting from you is that the public broadcasting system that we have today came about through some of it was a series of just fortunate accidents, but also some visionaries who worked really hard to make it happen. But what we have is a precious, special set of circumstances, a jewel, but there's no guarantee we're going to have this in the future. Is that about right?
Yeah, I think especially with state removal of funding, which used to sort of fill in the blanks where the national funding wasn't working. This makes the, you know, the pledging and then the philanthropic support all the more important. But the costs keep rising. So I think it is endangered. And I think there's some political reasons it might be endangered as well.
Yeah, and we don't know when that page is going to turn and when things are going to get really bad. In Texas, we don't have state funding for public broadcasting. It's all got to come from you know, the public and or the CPB Corporation for Public Broadcasting. And so, you know, what so define explain what the Corporation for Public Broadcasting is.
Yeah, I think this gets sort of to the heart of what public media is in a way with your question, which is what is the difference between public media and corporate media or just commercial media? And the answer is public media works from almost like an ideal. It's a mission statement based approach to media, which then it should not, or at least aspires to not, be beholden to third-party interests or regurgitate what third parties or private interests are interested in. So I think, you know, with public media, one of the origins of the concept is just this notion that equal access to education becomes the foundation for the different types of genres that are available.
And those different genres, what do you mean?
So you have like a home economics broadcast, and that becomes like cooking shows, but like for cable television later. Or you have, you know, language shows or history shows, and you end up getting entire forms of educational entertainment. where there's travelogues and travel kinds of shows. So all of these came from the idea that people could be instructed through media in ways that they couldn't necessarily access in their immediate. And I think that that kind of principle becomes the foundation for what public media is shaped to do that's different than commercial media.
So I got my start in radio working at a local community college station, KSYM. And at the time, we didn't do a whole lot of music programming, and the music we did was only classical music. But we would play these reel-to-reel tapes that we would get from universities from across the country. Most of them came from UT Austin, the Longhorn Radio Network. We'd get a reel, and it would be like an hour-long lecture, and that we would put that on, and we'd play that on the radio. That was that's what we did. And then, you know, later when the people weren't looking, we would play some punk rock music. But that's another story for another day. But, you know, that seemed to be what these, and there was no NPR station at the time in San Antonio. That's what we had. So was that normal?
Yeah. So, continue with the answer to your question. So, like, what the CPB does and then what it does with distribution is that it creates a degree of separation from government. And so if there's what we call state-based media, that could be like a propaganda network of a given country. It could be any country. And it's direct lines of information from the government, which might or might not be colored in one way. The CPB receives a certain amount of money per year from the government, usually about $500 million, a little bit more. And then it distributes it in three ways. One is for the maintenance of facilities, right? Really basic, just can we continue to broadcast. The second is research into audiences and to understand the audiences. And the third is through the development of programming with an educational bent, and that's really PBS and NPR. So PBS and NPR pull from that system at that point with, usually a couple degrees of separation from direct government intervention. And so along the way, what happens is that there's this entire distribution network by which universities and different public stations exchange programming with each other. And then there's a really robust producing sector around public media by which a lot of the programs that we enjoy are produced by people not directly with the CPB or NPR, but understand the system and are making great programming.
So in the minute and a half we have left, the book is The Victory of Public Broadcasting. Tell me about the victory.
The original moment in the 1930s when they passed those first regulations, almost 70% of all educational stations lost their licenses because of what we called that public interest mandate before. And what happened was it actually seemed to engender or inspire this entire social movement by which equal access to education through technology was then taken on all these parallel tracks across all these different states and sectors. So the victory was that they transformed that defeat over time and took about 40 years in total, about 30 years after the first regulation, into the victory of non-commercial media existing. So it's kind of a low bar at first for the U.S. compared to a lot of Europe and other places, including South America. But the victory was that, yes, we would have media that was not merely commercial, and that commercial media alone could not steward democracy. There needed to be other types of voices, other modes of participation, and that those modes of participation are actually constituent of the different types of rights that we have and the different voices and diversity of voices that are out there.
And I wonder, now that we're dealing with, the world of commercial podcasting and other types of broadcasting that's not in the public CPB world, will diversity, will quality, will serving the public, will that still be the North Star?
So I think the beauty, I mentioned the mission statement before, the beauty of public media and why it's so crucial is that no audience is too small. So commercial media by nature and by necessity has to try to recoup its investment, and that's good. But public media has no such mandate. It can always aspire to speak to 30 people in a community. It could be 3,000, it could be 3 million, depending on the programming. And that is the essence of public media, is the way that it can speak to local constituencies.
Josh Shepard is the author of the book, Shadow of the New Deal, The Victory of Public Broadcasting. Josh, thanks for coming on during our Pledge Drive week, helping us understand what we do around here a little bit better.
Thank you for having me.
And that's for The Source, and we're going to do more Pledge Drive right after this. Stick with us. And you are the public in public broadcasting. It's what you deserve. It's what you need. It's what keeps a community whole. Without your support for public broadcasting, Texas Public Radio, NPR, it would be a very different city. Trying to imagine without having, I remember when we didn't used to have NPR in San Antonio. And, this is a way to bring people together. It is a cohesive force. And we do need you to do your part so that we can come together and support the things that we support. We need you to call right now, 800-622-8977, and tell, and we can go to the TPR app. We got a donate button there on our tpr.org. Lots of ways you can do it, but you need to do it. And with me to tell you more, I'm joined by Joey Palacios, TPR reporter and intern man in charge of the interns, right?
Thanks,
is that
Dave.
What you do?
Yes. Do a bunch of things around here now. So right now, our goal for Pledge Drive is $224,549.
Yeah, when you put it that way, that sounds like a lot of money.
Just, little pennies here and there. No, but so all of that is what we need to make sure that the station is in operation, all of that. We also have the dollar-for-dollar match going on. So for every dollar that you give to Texas Public Radio, it is doubled. So keep in mind, so if you're doing $5 a month, that instantly becomes $10 a month, thanks to a bunch of generous donors who are supporting your donation as well. So call us at 800-622-8977. Go to tpr.org. That's 800-622-8977. And it wouldn't be radio if we didn't have like a little radio contest right now. So what we have going on right now is if you donate before 7 p.m., you can win a chance to earn a pair of tickets to Get the Lead Out's bombastic, epic, folky, and mystical performance at Stable Hall on Wednesday, May 15th. We're giving away one pair of tickets to catch this outstanding Led Zeppelin tribute band live. Everyone who donates to TPR is automatically qualified for entry, whether a one-time, new, or upgrading sustainer, as well as current sustainers. But if you can't donate, you still want to be entered into the drawing, you can learn how at tpr.org/contest rules. Again, that's 800-622-8977 or tpr.org.
And the number again, 800-622-8977. Go to the TPR app, go to tpr.org. Lots of ways to donate, but we do need your support because you are the community, you are the public and public radio. We cannot do it without you. If you think they don't need my pledge, you're wrong. We need your pledge because you are a listener and we need you on board. Give us a call right now, 800-622-8977. And thanks for listening.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted and produced by David Martin Davies. Kayla Padilla is our booking and engagement producer. Engineering support from Ruben Garcia, Jesse Reeves, and Steve Short. Dan Katz is TPR's Vice President of News. The Source is made possible with support from the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.